I'm Christopher Light, and this is The Connection. In a catalog of the prophets of modern womanhood, you might not expect to find an essay about the lesbian modernist writer Gertrude Stein sharing company with one about the man-loving, wisecracking, voluptuary Mae West, or for that matter, an appreciation of Ayn Rand, the cheerleader for capitalism and individualism, alongside a profile of Doris Lessing, the white African voice of global responsibility and communism. But the writer Claudia Roth Pierpont made connections among these and other women, women like the authors Anaïs Nin and Eudora Welty, and Hannah Arendt and Mary McCarthy. These are pre-movement women of a transitional age, as she writes, lives in which success is hard won, retreat and even breakdown are common, love is difficult, and children are nearly impossible. They're lives in which all that is ever certain is that books and plays and poems are being written. Connection listeners, we're talking about the passionate minds in Claudia Roth Pierpont's title of pathfinding women before there was any orthodoxy about the path. It's a remarkable variety of spirits, searching and writing, most of them in the first half of this century. The common thread may be just a defiant sort of hunger for something new. Do we recognize ourselves in our 21st century heads in these women? Give us a call at 1-800-423-8255. Make the passionate minds connection at 1-800-423-TALK. And welcome from a studio in New York to Claudia Roth Pierpont. We
Thank
love
you
this
much.
Book. It's unbelievably beautifully written and fresh and really stimulating without being in any way orthodox or argumentative. Yeah. What is the thread that connects all these women?
Well, the original idea was to deal with women who dealt with big subjects. In fact, the working title was Big Women, but in my mind, but I think they thought that would go in the diet section. So I came up with Passionate Minds. But the idea originally was women who took on big subjects like race, politics, sex. And then also it evolved as I went through them, women who had a big influence outside of literature. Some of them, as you've pointed out, really aren't even considered a part of literature. People like Ayn Rand, and yet they have tremendously devoted followers. And in the case of somebody like Margaret Mitchell, who wrote Gone with the Wind, actually had a huge impact on national history, on the way people in this country thought about the Civil War, Reconstruction. A 1930s novel had a lot to do with actually laws that were passed, with the Confederate flag flying again. These people had a tremendous impact on the way people lived, the way people thought. Mae West, obviously, who you mentioned right off the bat, is a prime example of that.
Some of them weren't very good writers, as you keep saying. I mean, Gertrude Stein, you're hard-pressed on her. Anaïs Nin, obviously, also you think she was sort of masquerading as a writer all that time.
Well, I did. I must say, each of these pieces took a lot of homework. I'd say each time I read everything I could, both by and about the person. And sometimes you fall in love with a writer all the more for reading every word. With a writer like Anaïs Nin, however, I guess I started to lose patience after a while going through all those diaries. I think the title of the piece is 35,000 pages of lies and sex. as a writer, I don't believe she quite exists, but as a force, somebody who people followed and thought about, her ideas mattered to a lot of people. And that has to be, if not, it does have to be respected in some ways. It certainly should be paid attention to in some ways.
We're staggered by the homework you did and the degree, the distillation of so much thinking about these lives. Gertrude Stein, I had forgotten, if I ever knew, how funny she was and how funny her story is. You call her, you refer to her books as kind of massive failures. The Making of Americans, her novel about her family, the first stunningly original disaster of modernism, call it. She's the bard of a culture of confusion, with a wonderfully theatrical sense of her mannish self. I love that line where she said, I'm very fond of yes, sir. And her notion that commas were feminine, so get rid of them.
Oh, that's a wonderful argument that goes on. As I worked on these women one after another, I didn't realize all the links at the start that would appear as I went through them. And one of them, which Gertrude Stein herself brings up over and over, is whether it's possible To write like a woman, whether it's desirable to write like a woman, whether there's a feminine style. I think she and Virginia Woolf had an enormous kind of tacit battle over this. Stein believing that, you know, long sentences, commas and things were not to be put up with. It was Stein really who taught Hemingway how to write in a style that we now call, you know, one of the most virile styles of the 20th century. Actually, it originates with Gertrude Stein. And Woolf took the opposite position, that, you know, a woman's writing was more convoluted, more involved. She might have said more perceptive, but she used virile as an insult. So they took very different positions on what it meant to be a man and a woman, and therefore what it meant to write like a man and write like a woman. Some people may think the distinction is ludicrous, that people write like who they are. But this was an issue that was quite alive, at least in the 20s, when styles were evolving, yeah.
Do you have a favorite among these women?
That's hard to say. I'd have to say, you know, you live with these women when you work with them, and certainly Mae West was a real joy to live with.
Talk about Mae West. First of all, explain why you believe she is, deep down, when all is said and done, a writer.
Yeah. Well, when it actually wasn't my idea to write about Mae West. It was suggested to me, and I looked into it. I loved the movies, and this is about 4 years ago, and I hadn't realized at first that she did write herself, so to speak. She wrote many, many plays, which are on Broadway and off Broadway, before her movie career. She was over 40 by the time she began in movies. She had a very strong, dramatic, and even angry voice, not a voice you would associate with the Mae West we know and love in those earlier years. She learned to criticize still, but with a smile, to seduce rather than to anger, but still all to the same point, which was that a woman could be this amazing creature. She is completely free, completely on her own, taking any man she wants, living, as she would have put it, the way men lived, taking their rights for her own, just naturally. And that was a pretty revolutionary thing to be. And since basically she wanted to be an actress and wanted to play this role, she had to write the roles herself, and she did. She wrote all her movie scripts. The jokes are hers. You know, later on she had
help. They're good. They're still great.
Oh, they're great. And
it's not the men in my life, it's the life in my men.
Yeah, yeah. Good.
That's her line?
To do with it. Yeah, yeah, yeah. I think Hollywood was afraid to touch her at the start. She was just too dangerous. Then she went into a George Raft movie, actually had a minor part in, I think, 1932. Couldn't stand the script, rewrote it. Raft was a friend of hers from her, you know, one of her gangster cronies in New York in the old days. She rewrote the part. That's where the line, goodness, what beautiful diamonds you have, goodness, had nothing to do with it, dearie. Her scenes are the only scenes that are alive in that movie, and it made Hollywood, you know, cut her back considerably, but give her a chance to go. And from 33 on, she went.
Where do you locate Mae West between Gertrude Stein and Virginia Woolf on what it sounds like to write like a woman?
Oh, that's a tough one. I don't think, you know, I think she must have thought of herself as writing like Mae West, and I think she thought of herself as sticking up for women very much. I don't know if she thought of herself as a stylist in that sense, which they both did. Maybe. Although I do think of her as a writer, and in fact she did write a couple of novels, or at least she dictated a couple of novels, I don't think she would have put herself forward in terms of style in that way or thought about it. For her, I think the content was what mattered. I'm not sure she would have put that on her map in the same way.
First of all, the phone for Connection listeners, and we're all in on this thing, is 1-800-423-8255 or 1-800-423-TALK. But I'm just wondering, someday there will be a sort of family tree of feminism or women's consciousness. Yeah. And the question is whether, you know, where we'll put these people on. And some of your subjects, I was fascinated by Olive Schreiner, whom I've not read her work. South African born, she wrote a famous story of an African farm in the 1880s, which was taken as a kind of reconciliation of, or an attempt to reconcile Darwinism and spiritual hunger.
And God, yeah.
And
yeah.
God, indeed. But she said,
need for belief, yeah.
You quote her saying, in a kind of intellectual feminist manifesto in the book, there is no fruit in the garden of knowledge. It is not our determination to eat.
Yeah,
where do you?
Great line.
Yeah, fabulous. So much good writing and distillation of good writing in your book. Where do you put these women in the kind of feminist evolution?
Well, I think Olive Schreiner is hardly one of the first. There have been feminists, but without using that word, I think forever, when there were women whose ambitions were simply too large to fit into the expectations of their society or their family, and they certainly didn't have to be writers. But writers, of course, tell us about it and let us see it, for other women. Sure, that line you quote of Schreiner's, which is so wonderful, is from actually a little treatise she wrote in 1911 called Women and Labor. She was fighting for the vote, and she said that, the old-fashioned labor women had, which was churning butter and making shoes and making clothes, is gone. And work is dignity, and we want dignity, and we want all kinds of jobs, and you can't keep them from us. And she has a very big place in this history. I think all of these women may, even those who don't fit exactly into our image of a revolutionary. I don't know where you'd put Anais and Nin in that. And yet I think all of them do speak out, even for their own lives, in terms of a larger sphere for a woman. I don't think there's one in the book, however, who would willingly have called herself a feminist,
Really?
who would have allowed herself
There are a
a
lot of them,
title.
obviously, who wouldn't, but wouldn't Mary McCarthy call herself a feminist? Doris Lessing?
Doris Lessing deliberately battled against it, as a
Really?
matter of fact. I think not because they had anything against the idea that women deserved all the rights of men, and basically some of them perhaps more rights than men. But I think, and this may be true of anybody who sort of battles her way out of a group that's being held back, each of them, I think, finally had a feeling of battling alone to such a degree of being separate from all groups, men and women, that I think identifying intensely with a group became almost insulting to each of them. Individualism had become so important for all of them, not only Ayn Rand, obviously, but I think the word, the identification with a group, with a movement, even Doris Lessing, who's still with us and may feel
Yes.
slightly differently now, but even as late as the 70s, when she was being pressed to use that word, she would back away from it. Just they were all above groups. They were all supremely themselves and had fought damn hard to get away from being identified with any group. And maybe especially groups of women who they didn't want to be like, remember, when they were young. They were getting away from what their mothers had represented, for the most part, from household, from
I
motherhood,
wonder if we'll
certainly.
come back to that, and American women will come back to that feeling, sort of rebel against the movement and see themselves individually. Camille Paglia writes about pre-war feminists, meaning Amelia Earhart or Julia Child is a perfect embodiment, a sort of women who took their power and their success, not necessarily for granted, but it was their own business and did it
Exactly.
without complaining, without campaigning.
Exactly.
Katharine Hepburn. I mean, do you want to revive that sort of style of feminism?
Well, I don't know about reviving any particular style. I think there's already been a backlash to a degree. This is no news against, hardcore feminism. Olive Schreiner's expression that these are women of a transitional age. She herself in the 1880s thought it was transitional. Lessing still lived it as transitional. I think in the talk that's gone on in the past few years, even about a figure like Hillary Clinton, I think everybody has a feeling that there is still a transitional stage that women who have, especially women who have children, and who have important work to do, be it writing or politics or anything, are drawn in perhaps more directions than one life can contain, and feel themselves therefore to be in transition. It may be a permanent transition. Who wants to give anything up once you've kind of got the possibility of having it all? It doesn't
Two
make it easy, but yeah.
additional questions, though. Among your transitional women, there are very few children. I mean,
Ah,
these
yeah.
mothers, these are not mothers of children. I
No.
wish you'd speak about the mothers that made them and the experience with their own mothers that sort of formed them. And then what is this rather conscious? I mean, there are abortions and, of course, there's lesbianism too, but a lot of decisions against children in your
Yeah.
book. Go back, though, to their own experiences of their mothers.
Of mothers. I certainly wasn't looking for that when I began, but I have to say that one of the major experiences over and again is a very strong mother, as in the case of Mae West, who worshipped her mother. Her mother was a German immigrant who fell in love with vaudeville, put her little one, her darling Mae, on the stage at 5 and 6. She started in Brooklyn, and she played in Uncle Tom's Cabin. She just did the theater circuit. It was her mother who encouraged her. Wes quoted her mother all the time later on, was completely devoted. I believe that Wes had her one real great romance with her mother, whom she adored. It was her mother who said, you can make a choice. You can use your emotions to have a great career, or you can waste them on the first man. Things like that. Even West's famous creation, you know, Diamond Lil, the figure we all picture from She'd Done Him Wrong with the big picture hat and the corset, was based on West's mother, who, whose name was Tilly, and whose father, whose husband, West's father, called her Champagne Till. It was all a tremendous act of devotion and of homage. And even, you know, in the late 50s when West wrote her memoirs, they were dedicated to her mother, who had made her and who had set up, even though this was a traditional woman who had four children and a marriage and no career, but West felt she had set her up for all the strength that she embodied for other women. Of course, she chose not to have children herself.
And, yeah, let's talk about that. Why did so many of them, renounce mothering?
Well, I think that's not hard to answer, in that it's so hard to do mothering, which is a life-consuming activity, if it's done well, and to have a big career of any kind. These are
life-consuming in the sense
women of
deadening, or life-fulfilling?
Oh, no, life-consuming, it can be the most fulfilling thing around, but it will take up the same years where you might be writing your book or making your film or having your campaign. One of the most poignant of figures in the book in this way, I think, is Doris Lessing, who married very young, 19 or so, had two children immediately, as her mother had done, couldn't stand living in a small South African city where she lived, and left her two children behind at the ages of something like 3 and 2. And these two children, she later had another child, and then finally, speaking of abortions and other decisions, decided to have a medical procedure by which she could have no more children, which she declared was one of the smartest, least neurotic acts she had ever done. Mm. But those two children left behind, I think, haunt her works for the next 50 years of writing. Mm. And in her memoirs, she returns to that as that's a horrendous sacrifice to make. Many of these other women, I think, saw that choice in advance. The choice may no longer be as absolute as it seemed to these women. I spend my years doing this, or I spend my years doing that, is what it seemed to many of them. And the pressure to be married, to have children, I mean, we are talking about the teens, the 20s, was quite intense. And you had to be a revolutionary and to risk a lot of disapproval to walk away from your children, you would still do that, but to walk away from a home in a small town before you were a famous writer, when you were just consumed with the desire to do something, do it big. You had a message. You wanted to write about the situation around you, about the world around you, and you had to have a lot of confidence to walk out of all the nets of family and say, no, I'm going to try this on my own. There's a wonderful line of Mae West that I think I kept glued to my typewriter while I worked in all this, and it's from her play Sex, which she wrote in 1926, which is an angry, angry play. And she's a whore, and another whore comes to her complaining about the men who have been around lately, and she says, Agnes, go it alone. Go it alone, Agnes. Mm. And that was a hard lesson for a lot of these women, and I think it was something they struggled toward, although many did marry, if not have children. You might say they dabbled in marriage, a lot of them.
Agnes, go it alone. That could have been the title, practically.
I thought, yeah, almost.
I just want to remind our listeners, 1-800-423-8255. We're talking with a marvelous writer herself, Claudia Roth Pierpont, who has collected 12 essays that appeared originally in the New Yorker magazine about women, transitional women, all daughters in a certain way of George Eliot.
Yes.
And the turn of the century, and a kind of undefined dawn of a new era. And it's also fascinating. I want to talk about the women that these women begat. I mean, including Virginia Woolf and Susan Sontag and Erica Jong in certain ways, and Adrienne Rich. And
all the people I didn't get in the book.
Yeah, well, another book, but people who have sort of picked up many complex themes and batons from these women. Join the conversation, Connection listeners, especially for people who have found in any one of these writers an important clue about our own lives. The writers that she profiles begin with Olive Schreiner, a South African, Gertrude Stein, Anna Eastnine, Mae West, Margaret Mitchell, Zora Neale Hurston, Eudora Welty, Marina Tsvetaeva, Ayn Rand, Doris Lessing, Hannah Arendt, and Mary McCarthy. Join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. Regina is on the line. Hello, Regina.
I just tuned into your program. I hope the question isn't out of the range of the book, but I was thinking mainly how these women, remarkable artists and writers that they were, did they manage to feel, some of them anyway, a sense of integration in their lives? And I ask that because often when I've read their works, and brilliant as the works are, I can't let go of the fact that they have given up something. There's a individualism, but there's an isolation. And I'm thinking prior to them of Elizabeth Cady Stanton, who married, had children, loved her home life, and had revolutionary thoughts that she was able to bring to bear on society. And she's unusual, and I want to know why some of these other women couldn't find their way into... Was there something happening in the culture that prevented them, that didn't prevent Stanton? Was there something going on in the nature of the women together? Was there an inclination, maybe, to stay away from the mainstream that kept them away from that integration? Or do you think they did have whole lives?
Regina, good question.
I think it's an excellent question. I think having a whole life is a different thing. It's a difficult thing to define. Not only Elizabeth Cady Stanton, but really one of the women who's the mother of this book would be Harriet Beecher Stowe, whose Uncle Tom's Cabin had a bigger influence, you know, on national history than probably any other novel. You know, the famous line by Abe Lincoln, "Here's the little lady who started the big war," and she certainly worked out of a family context. I'm hard put to give you a general explanation for all of these women.
Can I just interrupt you for 5 seconds to tell? Our listeners, you're listening to The Connection. Claudia Roth Pierpont, continue.
Well, they perhaps, you know, it may be a fact that I'm just thinking out loud here that they could get away from marriage and family and responsibility more easily than a figure like Elizabeth Cady Stanton or Harriet Beecher Stowe. That
can I mention just another mother of these women? We did a program on her last week, and she figures amazingly through this book is Saint Teresa of Avila. She's really kind of the challenge to so many of these women, an independent, strong-minded reform nun.
Absolutely.
And spirit.
Very important figure to George Eliot, as a matter of fact. Teresa is mentioned time and time again by George Eliot as a great heroine. In fact, this is interesting, and this does tie into Regina's question. George Eliot says, however, this is in Middlemarch, I think, that Teresa of Avila, who is the heroine of her heroine, Dorothea, could no longer have that career today anymore, that it is an age that breaks down Teresa's. And, of course, she was writing this in the mid-19th century, and her heroine, who tries to have such a career, cannot. She felt that societal forces were too strong that many hundred years later. There are whole lives. I wouldn't want to say they didn't have integrated lives. Maybe it's the century itself that has fractured, you know, family structure to a degree that those kind of big families with lots of children where a woman could produce several novels or works, tracts, important works like Elizabeth Cady Stanton. It just may be the whole family structure that has changed and allowed these women to walk out. I think one of the interesting things to me is one of the real marriage, the only real marriage that lasted through anybody's life of all the women I worked with was actually that of Gertrude Stein with Alice B. Toklas, which wasn't actually a legal marriage. In fact, when I called it a marriage in the article when it appeared in the New Yorker, I got quite a lot of angry mail complaining about the use of such a term for two women, although they called it that themselves. But they were together from 1908 until Stein's death in 1946. These lives have, I think, I suppose you could say they made enormous sacrifices in some ways of family.
And Regina, did you want to follow up?
I appreciate the answer, and I think what I was considering was whether that sacrifice always had to be, obviously in the transitional sense, I can see how it would be, but I get the feeling that that hasn't changed at all today. And I'm very curious as to why not. And you bring to my mind ideas that why should the family be sacrificed and why should the creative work be sacrificed? I just don't feel that you can feel yourself, your really inner whole self, if you're not extending yourself in both of those directions.
Claudia?
Well, I do think that's real personal choice. I think that there are writers today. There are women writers today. Anne Tyler is one I think of immediately, who has several children, lives quietly in the country, produces wonderful novels year after year. It can be done. Perhaps what we're looking at is simply a wider range of choices. It is possible, after all, that not every woman feels that she has to extend in those directions. There may be simply a greater drive toward achievement in one field or the other. I mean, I don't know that Mae West felt she was cut off from something by not having children. I think we can't know this, but maybe it's not quite a secure thing to say that this ideal is an absolute for everyone. It may simply be that people have fought their way to the right to different choices.
We're going to take a short break, but I hope when we come back, you'll talk about the lineage after these women, not only how they would have felt about the feminist movement. They were not movement people, as you say, but what would they have thought of Betty Friedan's analyses and Gloria Steinem's in the 60s, 70s, 80s, and 90s? And then also, I mean, the lineage to people like, you've mentioned Hillary, but Alice Munro or Catherine Ann Porter or lots of others. You don't mention Willa Cather. I'd love you to talk about the women that you didn't put in this book of transitional women writers and thinkers. We'll be back. This is The Connection from WBUR Boston and PRI. Funding for The Connection comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where The Connection is produced, and from the Allaire Corporation, empowering people with innovative internet technology and offering dynamic career opportunities at Allaire.com. From Boston University, this is I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection. We're talking about the complex ancestry of modern thinking about women and womanhood with Claudia Roth Pierpont, whose book is called Passionate Minds, Women Rewriting the World. 12, in this case, female writers from Gertrude Stein to Mary McCarthy, including Mae West and Eudora Welty. The phone is 1-800-423-8255. And the question, I suppose, is what strands people have found in these writers and this rather amazing variety of perspectives in assembling their own idea of women and womanhood. I want you to talk about successes. I wish you'd also just tell us a few more of the stories of these individuals. Zora Neale Hurston was a huge hit on American campuses again, long after her writing days, for that book, Their Eyes Are Watching God. Tell us about Zora Neale Hurston.
Oh, she's a wonderful figure. I had asked to write about her for a while and was very happy when an opportunity came up. Their Eyes Are Watching God is a spectacular novel. I know a few others in American literature, except maybe something like The Great Gatsby. It's a lyrical dream. It's perfectly sustained. It's like a high wire act that never comes down. It's written in black dialect, as it would have been said, which is probably something that makes people not even think of opening it if they haven't already done so. It did me before I opened it, and I fell in love with it from page one. It was published in 1936. It was decried at its time for being too tender and loving toward the situation in which blacks lived in the South at the time. In other words, at a moment when Richard Wright particularly denounced the book, were beginning to protest loudly and ferociously the conditions of blacks all over the country, but particularly in the South. Here was a woman who came along and said, look, we have lives, we have love lives, we have music, we have work, we have dignity. You haven't crushed us. You haven't taken it away from us. And many people thought this was a kind of a traitor, an act of being a traitor, that, in other words, she wasn't pressing hard enough for changes if it was presumed that the status quo could produce such a lyric, wonderful, kind of beautiful, mythic community such as she created. The book went out of print really fast. She went downhill, I'd say, after that in her life, wrote more, ended up, but didn't have any great success. It's ironic in a way. I think that Richard Wright, who's a wonderful writer, and if this were a book of men, I think he would be included in it as somebody who had an enormous influence, even beyond the range of literature. But it's strange to think that he's the one who then became a kind of a book of the month club favorite, had a huge career, a huge success in his denunciations of American society, whereas she, who found much to praise, sort of went out of sight in her lifetime. She ended up very tragically working as a maid in Florida. She ended up dying alone in a welfare home. She was buried in a segregated cemetery in Florida just a few days before the first sit-in at a Woolworth's lunch counter and the real explosion of the civil rights movement.
But it's fascinating because there are two sides of it. She is the mother in a certain way, or one of the many mothers from that Harlem Renaissance of the blues culture, and that celebrates, it doesn't ignore hardship, but does celebrate and affirm life.
Ah, yeah. In a strange way, she just missed the year, because it is a Harlem Renaissance book in a sense, but 36 is a little bit late for that. And it's the beginning of the real political conscious culture, when you had to be socially conscious and more protesting. 5 years before, and people would have said, this book is the fulfillment of everything that we thought would happen. The Harlem Renaissance really, if it had a political belief, it was that show what we can do. Look at our art. Look at our painting. Look at our poetry. Look at us. We're fabulous. America, claim us. And the presumption that social justice would follow upon this demonstration of profound ability. Well, social justice did not follow. The Scottsboro trials followed. Riots in Harlem followed. The ideal changed. And by 36, by the time this book came out, she sort of fulfilled something that had just passed. And even people who were outspoken, people like Alan Locke, who was called the Prince of the Harlem Renaissance, who were very outspoken for those ideals a few years before, found the novel lacking. They didn't think it was socially conscious enough. It wasn't going to change anything. And that was the new ideal. You're right. It is a Harlem Renaissance masterpiece, but it came out at the moment where the Renaissance had been kind of snuffed out by its failure to produce the social results it had aspired to. She was, however, rediscovered, as you said, by Alice Walker, who wrote an article in Ms. and in the 70s sometime, who carried on a real crusade for this novel and put
up a lot of people took it up very heartily. I mean, this was a book that was just carried around hand to hand.
Absolutely.
Week to week. 1-800-423-8255 makes the passionate minds connection. Claudia Roth-Pierpont, I want your take on who are the most representative or interesting or important for you successors of these passionate minds.
You mean current feminists?
Yeah, when you turn on the TV or enter a bookstore or go to the movies and or think of music, theater, dance, any place, where do you see the children of this generation and the marks of the older generation on them?
Oh, well, I think there are many, many places. I mean, there are many wonderful women writers among us now. There are women choreographers.
Name a few. I mean, name your favorites. And where do you come into this? Did these people shape you?
Did these people shape me? I think we have it a little bit easier now than these women did, in that they did fight some of the battles, and we can relax now. I think, again, the question that the woman asked before, it is perhaps a little easier now to have it all, to have the children and the career. Maybe not. Maybe people will disagree with me about that. I think there are great women artists out there. In choreography, I'd say Twyla Tharp is a favorite force of mine and has carried on. I mean, she choreographs brilliantly for men, but also for women. She had a wonderful line years ago when she had an all-female dance troupe, we're just a bunch of broads doing God's work. And that brings me back to one other thing. This whole discussion has been about feminism and what it means to be a woman working. But I think, and of course that runs through this book and it runs through the life of every one of these women, but I think they would all have said, this comes second. In a way, I think I wouldn't say I misrepresent them, but I or even do them a disservice, but I don't think any of one of them would have wanted to be considered a woman writer. They, women rewriting the world, they are women, but they were out to rewrite the world, and not only for the sake of what a woman had to say, but they all wanted to say something large, or many of them wanted to say something large about take Hannah Arendt, about what happened during World War II, how did the civilized world go mad. In Zora Neale Hurston, it was about race in the South. Eudora Welty, also about race in the South. In other words, they had subjects on their minds, and they wanted to speak out loud and clear and be heard, not about being women, but about things in the world, about history, about art, about the world itself. Being a woman became part of that argument because of what they had to do in order to get it said. But
take a deep breath. It's the caller's turn. Claudia Roth Pierpont, it's a pleasure. 1-800-423-8255 makes the connection. Ruth is calling from Lowville, New York. Welcome, Ruth.
Thank you. I'm calling to ask if any missionaries women were considered in the formation of her book. There are many good early missionary women writers, especially doctors from about 1850 on, who just simply went out without any ado, without any thought of feminism, per se, and developed most of the education and medicine which served as the basis for women's rights in Asia, Africa, and countries like that.
I can't say, I don't know exactly, you know, the names that you're referring to. Part of the idea behind this book was not only women who had large ambitions, which they do, but perhaps because Gone with the Wind was the second piece I wrote, and Olive Schreiner's The Story of an African Farm was the first in what went toward this collection. The idea also became women who had a large influence on a lot of people. Which isn't to say that these missionary women didn't have an influence in the spheres in which they worked. But I think I was also after something that had to do with popular writing to a degree and the distinction between what we call literature and popular writing. I was made extremely aware of it when I worked on Ayn Rand, who was an it would be heretical to tell anybody, you know, in the real literary world that I was working on Ayn Rand. And yet I was completely aware that when I carried her books around, if I carried around my enormous paperback of Atlas Shrugged, I was stunned by how many people would come up to me on the street, a stewardess on an airplane, and say, you know, that book changed my life. That is the most important book to me. People who really did call it a kind of second Bible to them. That was part of the choice of the women who went into this book. It diversified a little bit later on, but Hannah Arendt, Margaret Mitchell, certainly. These people wrote books, I mean, the way I tried to put it was books that were passed around eagerly from person to person, reread. The kind of book, if you took it out of the library, you'd find it had been underlined and was dog-eared. And these books that you speak of, I don't know, again, exactly who you're referring to. I'm sure they're worthy works. In fact, Olive Schreiner was a missionary's daughter.
I was going to say, and Doris Lessing could have been almost, right?
A missionary?
No, could have been a missionary's daughter.
Oh, yes, absolutely. I think the religious background and a sense of mission was certainly behind a lot of these women. Schreiner comes closest to having you know, been really involved in the sphere you're talking about, and her book of the 1880s did involve religion, or in fact the loss of religious faith as a frightening but perhaps necessary part of the time in which she lived.
Ruth, thank you. 1-800-423-8255 makes the Passionate Minds connection. Hope is calling from Cambridge.
This is a something a little bit off, perhaps, but it's the people I'm talking about, the people that tried to combine the writing career with the family. And I have Tilly Olson wrote a book called Silences.
Yes, it's a wonderful book.
And she had, I don't know, maybe 50 women whose work she thought would have been capable of being up with the best if they hadn't had to give their lives to their husband's careers or their children. And she mentions a whole group of people who have distinguished husbands, and I was one of them. And she spoke of how the talents of these women were equal, or sometimes she thought crazily that might have been better than their husbands, but that was a, it's a very difficult thing, and then yet you have a rich life that you want to write from.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Tilly Olson, I think also Tilly Olson's wonderful book does address, again, the question of the First Lady of Regina, who called, in that Silences is about the fact, it's about women who didn't write as much as they might have had they not.
And then she was one of them, of course.
Yeah. Yeah. She had a wonderful riposte, though, if I remember. Tilly Olson herself, I believe, raised 4 children and worked in a factory and lived the life of what you might call a good, solid, you know, ordinary, a good working class life, came to her writing very late, writes absolutely, is a brilliant, brilliant writer, and is caught, you have to, and it, this does go back to the earlier question, is caught kind of on the knife edge to say, people have said, I believe Tilly Olson says, at some point somebody said to her, don't you regret all the years, that all the books you haven't written? And she said, well, how could I regret my children, my 4 children? But she did have them, and to raise, you know, raise children when you didn't have money for nannies, etc.
Why regret anything? You quote, I presume it's, you say Browning, I presume it's Elizabeth Barrett Browning, a wonderful line, what I aspired to be and was not comforts me.
Mm-hmm.
Is that Elizabeth Barrett Browning?
It's Robert Browning, actually, yeah.
Ah.
But that is what Olive Schreiner said. And, yeah, I think a lot of people, well, a lot, that's a wonderful line at the end of her life, if you felt that you have not, you had not lived out everything you wanted. But you tried, you had it in mind. I think Olive Schreiner at the end of her life felt she had been a failure. In some ways, so did Susan B. Anthony. We were speaking of Elizabeth Cady Stanton earlier on, felt that the causes she had struggled for had not happened. Susan B. Anthony died before women got the vote. Olive Schreiner did not live to see, you know, her fondest dreams of women's votes, women's work coming through. But she knew this, and this, in a way, perhaps this is the hope of saying you're part of a transitional stage. You hope that better will yet come and that you are part of a bridge that is being built. And if she had not lived the life she, you know, completely wished to have lived, she took great comfort in the thought that others after her, her spiritual daughters, if not her actual daughters, would benefit by her example, even as she said, her mistakes, her terrible, terrible mistakes.
1-800-423-8255 makes the Passionate Minds connection. Ernie is calling from a car phone. Hello, Ernie.
Hi, Chris. How are you?
Good.
I just want to ask one question. It may have already been answered, but in regards to the other writers, was there a common theme where these writers were financially better off and able to support themselves, had more financial independence? Or were they like the ones you just mentioned that really suffered?
Very few of them had real financial independence, wouldn't you say?
Very Claudia? Few. Gertrude Stein did. And, you know, what's interesting about that is that it may have allowed her to, this may undersell Gertrude Stein, this may not be fair, but both Stein and Virginia Woolf had a lot of money. They were able to, in other words, afford to write the way they wanted to. Virginia Woolf is very vocal about this, as you know, in a room of one's own. She talks about the need to have a certain amount, a writer must have a room and a certain amount of money a year to get everything done. And she and her husband, Leonard Woolf, agreed later on, she couldn't have done what she did, the slow, painstaking perfectionism, the experimentation of her work, the I don't care about sales quality of her work, had she had to earn a living as a shop girl all day. The same is true of Stein. These two women who wrote in these radical, experimental, fascinating styles didn't have to worry about sales. They wanted sales. Everybody wants sales. But they didn't have to worry about that at all. Whereas somebody like Hurston, who was, you know, just entirely poor, her career went you know, down the drain without the proper sales.
And somebody like Neen just sort of kidded herself that she was really living off her husband.
Neen presented this image to the world and I think captivated, especially many college-age women in the 70s who read those diaries. I've had many women say to me without having actually read the piece and just hearing that it has a few criticisms to make, saying things like, but she was out there. And
Claudia, stand by.
I
want to tell listeners, you're listening to The Connection. 1-800-423-8255 is the phone. Elizabeth is calling from Norfolk, Virginia.
Hi.
Welcome, Elizabeth.
I'm excited that someone is writing about Anis Nin nowadays. And when I was in college, no one would take... my teacher in women's studies wouldn't let me write a paper on her because she felt she wasn't a serious woman writer. Uh-huh. And I'm very excited to, I want to get your book and read about what you have to say.
What did she mean to you, Elizabeth?
I'm sorry?
What did Anais Nin mean to you?
Well, I really,
And when was this, if I may?
This was about 10 years ago when I was in college, and what mm-hmm. I contrasted her with someone like Adrienne Rich, who depressed mm-hmm. me as a young woman, because she saw she saw everything, it seemed to me, in black and white, and mm-hmm. she ignored so much, I felt, of being feminine and all of these possibilities that you had and this fantasy life you could have, and I loved the way Anais Nin embraced the life of your fantasies, all of these wonderful, creative, yeah. crazy, wacky fantasies that she sometimes seemed to have. Mm-hmm. And I love that. And it encouraged me to write a diary. And I think mm-hmm. that interior voice is so important for women as they try to have it all. And she really encouraged me in a much, much better way than some of these other writers that everyone told me were more important.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think I'm in big trouble here.
I was going to say, Elizabeth, you may not have heard of it. I mean, I think Claudia Pierpont has doubts as to whether Nin is a real writer.
I understand why people wouldn't take... I don't think her writing is anything compared to someone like George Eliot or someone like Tilly Olson. But because she did it anyway, because she wasn't artistically wonderful, but she mm-hmm. went ahead and she wrote these journals for herself, I think, to a certain extent, I felt that kind of helped me to see that even if my personal ideas mm-hmm. and work were not going to change the world, that they needed to have value to myself.
Okay.
Well, that's certainly you know, reason enough to say that she is an important figure. I mean, she's not in the book because she's in the book and she's not negligible. Obviously, I don't think she's negligible. I mean, I found her very difficult to deal with, and not only because of her writing style. There's more in the book about an abortion, about lies, about a kind of narcissism, which brings in another danger of what these women looked like. I think beauty as a commodity. You need to have it, and it certainly makes it easier for you to have it anyway, but having too much of it can become a terrible danger, a trap. And I think the narcissism in Nin's writing got to me after a while. I you know, this book does have a lot about certain men, many men in it also. And when I worked on Nin, I began reading Henry Miller, who was very involved with Nin. I had never read him before and had pretty much accepted the views of my generation, the 70s college generation, that he was a reprehensible, you know, male pig. I opened Tropic of Cancer and fell in love with it. I thought it was the most funny, brilliant, I still do, wonderful, original book. And in a way, he carried me through the way I thought of it, the piece on Nin. He was a brilliant writer who I could consider side by side with her, since their lives were terribly involved, and I don't think we would even know Nin's diaries today had he not sponsored them. And eventually it was he who had them published, more or less, or his influence that saw to their publication finally many, many years after they were written. In fact, I have what I called I got a lot of angry mail about the Nin piece by people who did love her and feel I was too harsh on her, but a lot of nice mail, which I used to call my As a Man letters, which I'd get from men, because they all started, "As a man, I want to thank you for what you had to say about Henry Miller, for being willing to look at him as a writer and an original and interesting voice."
And a moralist. And yet you could do a companion volume on the men in the lives of these passionate minds. I mean, it's an amazing range, from Cecil Rhodes in the case of Olive Schreiner to Havelock Ellis to Herbert Spencer to...
No, I think
Wilson,
that's a great idea. You may have given me a project.
Otto Rank. We didn't speak enough, though, of the women you left out. Mae Sarton, for example, or Willa Cather. What about the women you almost did and might do in another volume?
Well, there are, of course, any number of choices. I did write about Colette for the magazine, but after the book, she is a figure who might have entered in. There were some I would have liked to have written about Flannery O'Connor, but there was sort of enough of the American South here. Willa Cather is a great figure with a very complex and fascinating views of independence, and I would maybe there will be volume two. I don't know.
This is so interesting. Susan Sontag, will she ever figure in one of your books?
Oh, I think she's a direct descendant of these people. Fascinating, especially becoming a novelist now, a wonderful novelist later in her life. Very much a descendant, certainly of George Eliot, as they all were.
Yeah.
At times I thought this book, another working title for this book, I'm afraid, was "I'm Not Being George Eliot."
Listen, we're going to have to continue this, but we so admire the book and so enjoy talking with you.
Thank you.
Claudia Roth Pierpont's book is Passionate Minds, Women Rewriting the World. Thank you. And thanks to all the callers and listeners, as always. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection from WBUR Boston. Funding for The Connection comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where The Connection is produced, and from the Allaire Corporation.
PRI, Public Radio International.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Suffolk University's Sawyer School of Management, offering a fully online MBA program designed for busy people. Information at suffolkemba.org. By Lebo.